Thank you. You may be seated. And good morning to everyone. We will begin this morning with introductions from the court. My name is Mike Havikin, and I am the Chief Justice, and now, by order of seniority, as to service on the court. The other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Justice Lindsay Miller Lerman, participating by WebEx.
William Castle, good morning.
Stephanie Stacy, good morning.
Good morning, Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Patrick, good morning.
John Friedman.
Thank you, members of the court. Now a few items of business before we begin. We appreciate all of you out there being masked, my only obvious suggestion is when you are presenting to the court, please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. Otherwise, we appreciate your wearing your mask today. And the other item of business that everybody should be interested in is that on the last three cases of the day, Justice Miller Lerman is recused, and Judge George Thompson from the second district court judge for the second judicial district will be joining the court. With that in mind, the first case of the day is State versus Morton. Counsel, Mr. Lewis, do you have any questions before you begin? And Mr. Broughton or Ms. Burton? Okay, very good. This is a petition for further review. Mr. Lewis, you may approach and you may proceed.
Good morning. May I please report? Matt Lewis, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Nebraska. This petition for further review stems from Mr. Morton's direct appeal of his convictions, assigning several errors, including an excessive sentence assignment. The Court of Appeals affirmed the district court in all but the sentence to count two. The state's brief and PFR lays out most of its concerns with regards to that finding of an abuse of discretion by the Court of Appeals. But I'd like to just highlight a few points from that. Mr. Morton was sentenced to 15 to 20 years on manslaughter, count 2A felony, that was count one, and then 30 to 40 years for possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony consecutive to count one. It was this second sentence that the Court of Appeals found abuse of discretion with. The Court of Appeals found no abuse of discretion with count one, but did find for count two and reduced that sentence to 10 to 15 years consecutive to the remaining sentence in count one. It's largely based its reasoning in comparison to other cases, which it thought represented an incongruity or lack of consistency in sentencing across the selections that it provided, and then also its interpretation of the facts compared to those that were considered by the district court in its original sentencing order, as provided in the state's PFR.
Appellate courts review sentences on a chart-by-charge basis or in their totality?
I believe that that has been the trend, has been to review them on a sentence-by-sentence basis.
What I'm saying, within one case, if you have multiple charges.
Yes, I think that that has been how it has been done.
What has
I reviewed the sentences individually within the total sentencing
count order. By count.
Count by count rather than the total sentencing order in total.
Do you think that's how the trial judges are thinking?
I don't know if I could speculate as to how the trial judges are thinking. I think that that is definitely what appellants tend to see when I think that they look at the total sentence that was given to them in deciding whether or not it was excessive or not. I think that I'm sure that there are plenty of district court judges and sentencing court judges, county court judges for that matter, that do sort of consider the overall sentencing effect, but I'm not aware that that was the issue here. The district court in this case seemed to really sort of consider them as separate things, separate entities.
If this court were to endorse a comparison analysis when looking at an excessive sentence claim, where would the appellate court get reliable data on the appropriate comparison cases? Where would we look?
I'm not entirely sure. I think that that's part of the problem that is raised by the state in its PFR, is that, and as this court has stated on multiple occasions, that comparing, finding other cases and curating other cases and curating other sentencing outcomes in order to create a sentencing outcome in the current case presents its own problems. Seen in this case, they pulled out, a couple of unpublished opinions from the Court of Appeals. I'm sure that there are others that are out there that could say something quite to the opposite. But as far as where to get that data, or what cases would be acceptable to pull those sentencing outcomes from, I'm not entirely sure. I think that it presents a fairly decent problem, not just for the bench, but, also for the attorneys that would be defense attorneys would be trying to represent and advocate for sentences, as well as the state, getting into their sentencing arguments as to what would be a comparable congruous sentence throughout the sentencing.
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller-Lerman. Is there not an area in the law, of the law, where we are invited to do so, to compare at the appellate level?
I'm not aware of one off the top of my head, but
I think Justice Miller-Lerman's referring to capital sentencing cases.
There does exist that there. This is fairly different from that, but yes, I guess that does lie out there. But that was also not part of the rationale and reasoning that was cited by the Court of Appeals when it came to the determination, looking at the congruity of the sentences and the comparison of sentences across cases.
How is an appellate court to determine abuse of discretion? Have we weighed in on that?
Well, the abuse of discretion standard is looking at whether or not that sentence is within the statutorily prescribed limits, whether or not it's supported by the competent evidence, whether or not the district court looked at irrelevant considerations, if there was any sort of other peripheral considerations, I guess it would fit under the irrelevant considerations by the district court in forming the sentence. So that is the traditional abuse of discretion standard, has been applied to sentencing for quite some time now.
There are times, it seems, that this court or the Court of Appeals checked all those boxes and said it was still an abuse of discretion. Or am I wrong?
No, you're correct. I mean, there have been cases that have come up. The Court of Appeals cited State versus Munya. I knew I was going to mess that up when I got up here, where this court, looked at whether or not, based on the facts, based on the consideration by the district court, whether or not the sentence was then excessive. And it was a fairly straightforward analysis. And I'm not trying to say that that was an inappropriate consideration, in hindsight. I guess what I'm saying is that the Court of Appeals here drew out a couple of things that this court has specifically said, this is looking at other cases in order to triangulate whether or not this is a good sentence. Is not, sort of the way to go about doing business. One, number two, looking at a de novo review of the record and sort of reimagining or reweighing or placing your interpretation of facts and the events in order to inform what sentence.
I beg your pardon. Was Irumanya a unanimous decision?
I can't recall that off the top of my head.
That was a life to life.
Yes.
Matter, was it not?
Yes, it was.
And that was the minimum, was what was changed by this court.
Correct. Yeah.
In cases other than the death penalty matters we discussed, does a trial court have a duty to complete a comparative analysis before imposing a sentence?
I do not believe that they do. I don't believe that that standard has ever been put upon them in order to look at other cases in order to determine what sentence they're supposed to render at the end of the day, I don't think that that has ever been dependent on other cases being brought into the fold in order to explain a sentence.
As part of the Court of Appeals analysis, in their opinion, they talk about the proportionality between the two sentences with the predicate offense, and they make some decisions on what the predicate offense should be. But is there any law or statutory requirement that a firearm or weapons charge has to be somehow proportional to the predicate offense?
No, and then that's another point that we, you know, try to highlight in the brief, that these are two distinct offenses with two distinct penalty structures. They are two different felonies. They have different, you know, sort of penalty brackets that they're working with. This is also the product of a plea deal where the original charge was second degree murder was the class 1B felony that was pled down to manslaughter. It's 20 to life. Manslaughter, the class 2A felony is 0 to 20. And then the firearms offense was originally, you know, two counts of use of a firearm to commit a felony. That was class 1C felony, 5 to 50 years. So those are pretty large, wide berths in the sentencing structure. So no, I'm not aware of anything that says that those things need to be considered. But I think also when you look at the record and you look at what was originally charged versus what was pled to, I think that you end up in a position where you're looking at potentially an outcome such as this coming down the pike. Just really briefly, the Court of Appeals also talked quite a bit about some of the facts that it found informative in the case, specifically Mr. Morton's apparent intent not to harm any specific individual. This is sort of stands in contrast to the district court's considerations of, you know, you brought a gun to a fight, you discharged it at a group of people indiscriminately, and it hit and killed somebody. I think that the state tries to make the point in its brief that the chance that there was going to be some sort of injury as a result of this conduct was fairly high. And it there might also be some luck involved that, you know, more people weren't hurt. That reading of the facts stands in contrast to what the Court of Appeals looked at and seemed to suggest was merely just a discharge of a firearm in a setting towards a dwelling that happened to hit somebody. But I think in that factual setup, it was almost inevitable that something like this was going to happen. In total, the state would submit that the Court of Appeals finding of abuse of discretion to the sentence order for count 2 was not reached correctly by the Court of Appeals. I would ask this court to reverse if there are no further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Burton. Good morning to you.
Morning. May it please the court, counsel, myself, I'm Mona Burton. Myself and John Broughton are the attorneys for Mr. Natavian Morton. Today, we respectfully request that this court affirm the Court of Appeals decision that count 2, this trial court sentence of count 2, for possession of a firearm and the commission of a felony was excessive, amounted to an abuse of discretion, and therefore the resentence for the Court of Appeals should also be, we're asking that it be affirmed as well. Mr. Bart was originally sentenced 30 to 40 years for that count, and the resentence by the Court of Appeals was 15 to 20 years. This court was asked, and I believe it was in State v. Blaha, and I don't remember the name or the year of that case, but was asked whether or not Nebraska revised statute 29-2308, and that's the statute that allows appellate courts, if it finds an abuse of discretion and finds a sentence to be excessive, to resentence an individual. And in State v. Blaha, this court was asked whether or not that statute had become meaningless. And this court stated, no, it's not meaningless, but it should be used on rare occasions. And this is one of those rare occasions. Mr. Morton pled guilty or no contest to manslaughter, 15 to 20 years. He received a sentence to 15 to 20 years, near the max. And then for possession of the firearm to commit the manslaughter, the sentence was doubled, 30 to 40 years. In reviewing the State v. Smith factors, Mr. Morton was 16 years old at the time of this offense. He was a sophomore in high school. As far as his experience at that young age, he had little to no experience. That buttresses into a criminal record. He had no criminal record. And when I state no criminal record, that includes no juvenile record. And reviewing the PSR and the probation office, doing all the testing and providing the criminogenic factors, well, the only incident for Mr. Morton was a middle school
height, and all the criminogenic factors showed a medium to low risk to reoffend. Now, as noted, the Attorney General takes issue with the Court of Appeals doing a proportionality analysis, looking at a handful of cases to determine if this sentence, specifically the sentence to count two, was an outlier. And while that's not mandatory, it can be helpful in certain circumstances. And this court did just that in State v. Gibson in 2019, when the Attorney General or the state appealed an excessively lenient sentence of probation.
Does the district court, the trial court, have a duty to do a proportionality analysis before it imposes a sentence?
No, Your Honor.
Explain to me how then it can be an abuse of discretion that they didn't do so, and the Court of Appeals now substitutes its interpretations of what happened at trial for the district court making that sentence.
On abuse of discretion, you look at whether or not, when you review the record and review the court's comments of the on the record but pronouncing sentence, whether or not that the rationale was untenable, whether or not the court gave any rationale.
What rationale did the court?
No rationale. There is no rationale why the trial court doubled Mr. Morton's sentence on count two, the possession of a firearm.
Have we ever said they're required to?
I believe the courts have said it's helpful if they do that, but when you're looking for harmless error and looking at untenable, which means not supportive, that's what this court has to look toward, is the record and what was pronounced and what was said by the trial court.
The trial court said it took into consideration all the statutory factors and gave consideration to your client's age before it pronounced sentence. That is correct. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And then the Court of Appeals seemed to say that that wasn't enough. Said, although they, the trial court said they did that, there wasn't anything on the record that really articulated that. Is that a correct interpretation of the Court of Appeals decision?
I would say yes. The trial court did articulate that it noted or it considered Mr. Morton's young age, lack of criminal record. It did not reflect on why the sentence for the possession of the firearm, which was used to effectuate the manslaughter, was doubled. It did not state why. In reaching the court, when the Court of Appeals reached its decision, not only did it look at a handful of cases, but it also looked at the incongruency of why someone sentenced for possession of a firearm that was used in the predicate offense is double.
And is the Court of Appeals raising the bar for the trial court, saying not only you have to say it, then you have to explain it? What the factors, how they weighed into your decision on the sentencing, is that raising the bar for the trial courts?
I don't believe it's raising the bar. It would certainly be helpful when you're looking at an abuse of discretion, specifically what the trial court reviewed and why, especially in this case. Again, this is a rare case, and this is why I believe 292308 is triggered. Because there's no rationale provided on the record.
Did not the trial court least hint at factually that perhaps the trial court did not believe that this was random at all? Was not there a comment that something to the effect of what a coincidence that the person who was the target of all of this melee was the one who ended up being shot?
The trial court did mention that the intent of bringing the gun, Mr. Morton was handed a gun, I believe, when he was in the back seat of the car on the way to this environment. So that was an intentional act. He did have the gun and unlawful discharge.
Isn't there a suggestion by the trial court, at least, that the judge thought that it was that this the victim here was deliberately shot, that this wasn't a random shot into a mass crowd at all?
I cannot remember the exact words of the trial court, but she did wonder whether or not Mr. Morton was unlucky. But Mr. Morton made no statement. When he was interviewed, Mr. Morton stated he did not go there intending to shoot anyone individual. When you look at the factual basis and the facts presented to the court, this was unintentional manslaughter. It was an unlawful act manslaughter, discharge of a weapon. This was not sudden quarrel manslaughter.
Did the trial court also make a comment that you got a very good plea agreement in this case.
She did mention the plea agreement.
Is that relevant to what we're doing?
I believe what's relevant is what he's actually convicted of, Your Honor. Originally, he was charged with second-degree murder. Again, this was not intentional crime. This was unintentional manslaughter.
I'm sorry, I'll interrupt real quick. Looking at the information, it looks like it was charged without malice upon sudden quarrel or in the alternative, the unintentional. Was there something in the pleading when he actually pled that they struck part of that?
It wasn't struck, but when you look at the factual basis, it's clear that the prosecutor indicated this was an unintentional manslaughter. It's clear when you look at defense counsel's comments, this was unintentional manslaughter.
Is that because he quoted your client's statement saying, "I didn't intend to shoot anybody"? Because that's the part where I believe in the factual basis that comes in that it was unintentional, but that was all from your client's version of events that was given to an officer, wasn't it?
He did make those statements that he did not intend to shoot Mr. Union or anyone else. I'm trying to recall specifically the factual basis other than it did not request further review on this piece of the sufficiency of the factual basis for count two. But I did note that it was clear in the factual basis that this was meant to be an unintentional manslaughter. And when you look at the Court of Appeals decision, again, it did not rely solely on comparing a handful of cases. It also looked at the incongruency of doubling the sentence for the firearm conviction as to that of the predicate offense.
Isn't the permissible statutory range for the two offenses, isn't the use of the weapon charge double the maximum charge of the manslaughter conviction?
The range is 1 to 50, as opposed to, I believe, the 20 is.
So it's more max. Than that.
It is.
And doesn't that reflect a legislative declaration that use of a weapon is to be considered that plus a mandatory consecutive, that the legislature deems that as very serious?
I believe the legislature does deem the offense serious, which is why it made it mandatorily consecutive. It does not want people committing felonies with dangerous weapons, but there's still an incongruency that you would double the offense for the possession charge to that of the predicate offense, which cost someone's life. And that's what the Court of Appeals is focusing on. It's inconsistent, incongruent.
Well, if the judge had given a maximum sentence on both of them, it would have been more than double.
It would have been more than double. But he was close to the ceiling. And when you look at this court's opinion in Aramagna, did I pronounce that right?
Also.
Okay. Mr. Aramagna was 23 years old, no criminal record, shot and killed one person, severely wounded someone else. And the judge there gave him life to life. Now that is the max. Mr. Morton was close to the max on both of these charges.
Wasn't Aramagna a divided opinion?
I'm sorry, wasn't he?
Wasn't it a divided opinion?
It was a divided opinion, Your Honor. But the plurality noted that where's the ceiling for someone who is young, no criminal record, the brain is not fully developed, impulsive. Where's this, when you're that close to the ceiling, what do you do with someone down the line who's older, more mature, and has a significant criminal record? And I would ask this court to, now that I say that I'm out of time, to affirm the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments then on State versus Morton. And the court will go on to the second case of the day, which is Kaiser versus Kaiser. I believe the appellant in this case is going to appear by WebEx.